7:43 here on the Mighty 690. It is time for our chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. We have joining us David Skronks and James Coover. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, good to have you guys. So, it's going to be warming up here today. It doesn't feel like it. It feels 29 degrees.
A little chilly this morning.
I don't like this return to winter here, but no, we're going to be working on it. In fact, we have some fire weather concerns on Friday, so they've already issued a fire weather watch, and it's been a while since I've seen one of those, so we're
about
getting back into
it.
So anyway, starting first with David and your update, you say that there's a wildlife judging contest that's going to get ready and gearing up for and getting the kids ready for, so tell us about it.
Yeah, so we just started meeting with the kids to gear up for it, so I wanted to share a little bit about it because it's open to any kid that's involved in 4-H and FFA, and it's kind of a lesser known contest. You know, of course, livestock judging contests are really big. But this one is kind of a unique contest for kids that are maybe interested more in wildlife, like fishing and hunting, to learn a little bit more about it. So WEP is what we call it for short. So those acronyms stand for Wildlife Habitat Evaluation Program. And it's actually a nationwide program, and then there's a state contest that's being held the beginning of May. And so each year the contest focuses on a different ecoregion. So this year it's focusing on the eastern deciduous forest. So what the kids are learning and what we go over with the kids, a few kids have done it. This will be their third year. We have a couple kids that are new to it this year. So they're going to be learning about that ecoregion, the wildlife that is native to that region, and how to manage habitat for those wildlife. And it includes, you know, different types of fish, snakes, birds, mammals, all types of wildlife that are found in the region. So they'll learn how to identify those animals based, you know, on a picture of the animal itself, tracks that animal makes for the birds, what eggs they lay look like for every species. And then they'll also learn how to look at an area such as a forest or a piece of land and kind of get an ideal about what management practices need to be done to improve it as habitat for the wildlife. So when they travel to the contest, they'll have a general kind of ID portion, general wildlife knowledge about the species they've learned about. And they'll also take them out to a wildlife area and kind of just turn the kids loose and let them, they'll kind of give them a scenario of what animals they're managing the land for, and then the kids walk around and, you know, look at the land, get an ideal of what it needs more of, maybe even what it needs less of. If there's something, for example, like a lot of cedar trees in the area, how to remove those to improve wildlife habitat. And then so they'll write up a management plan, and then they'll also kind of give reasons. So for folks that are familiar with livestock judging, it's kind of a different way of giving reasons. It's basically just explaining their plan and why they decided to do that in their plan, what animals it would benefit. So it's a pretty cool program. The kids are really motivated, so we're practicing with them every week leading up to the contest. But there's still time if there's a kid out there that's interested in joining. We just got started last week, so they're more than welcome to join us and check it out.
So is there an area where you meet, or a location where the kids are eligible, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so any youth 9 to 19, there's a junior team and a senior team in the Wildcat District is welcome to participate in it. We're meeting in Altamont at the extension office there. It's kind of the middle spot for the district, and at the moment most of the kids participating are close to the Altamont office.
Good deal. So just give the Altamont office a call there for more information if people want to sign up.
Yeah, or any office, and they can put you in contact with me.
Well, that's great. Well, very good, David. That is good. Also wanted to talk about the some testing for food plots. As we know, people are starting to think about gardening and everything this time of year.
Yeah, so it's kind of like the general time of year where we all start getting a lot more soil tests in the office and questions about soil tests. Everyone's excited about, you know, the springtime weather. So I wanted to just talk briefly about soil testing for food plots. I've gotten a few questions about those. And just like we've all talked on here, I'm sure, about soil testing for our different areas, food plots are kind of the same way. So the basic test package we offer covers phosphorus, potassium, and pH levels in your soil. And you want to take at least 2 cups of soil per sample for us to be able to send it off to the lab and get a test back. And then how many samples you turn in will depend on how big of an area that you're sampling. And we have soil probes available at the office that you can borrow, and that gives you a good core sample of your soil. So you're looking at probably 10 to 15 core samples for one soil sample. And depending on the area you're sampling, if it's all pretty much the same, then you can take just like a random grid pattern of those cores, mix them all together, and take your 2 cups out of that. But maybe you've had this food plot before, or the area is a section of a crop field that's done poorly. If you notice like one part of it, plants grow really good in, and then the other part they never really do, then you'll want to split that up into at least 2 different samples, because you'll probably need different fertilization rates. Because the nutrient levels in that soil are most likely different, and that's why one side is doing poorer. And then also, if you're looking at locations to plant a food plot, you of course you want a water source nearby, good cover nearby. And sometimes if you can get a little bit of distance from crop fields, that will help you out too, especially for like deer will, unfortunately for the farmers, really visit those wheat fields at the moment, and then soybean fields later to the summer. They naturally go to those areas. So if you plant a food plot right next to it, sometimes the deer will still visit your food plot, but a lot of times they'll still go to that crop field.
I'm trying to have something to maybe draw them away from, you know, some of it, but it's always a bit of a challenge with the deer.
Yeah.
I know one thing that we've had luck with as far as fencing goes is if you stagger 2 fences and you have the different wires at different heights, and they have a really hard time judging that, so they'll be a little more hesitant to jump over them. But
There's a few different fence designs for deer, but none of them work that well.
Yeah.
They could jump so far.
Oh, I know, it's wild. If you can try and mess with their depth perception, it seems to be one of the better ways to deal with it. It throws them off a little bit.
Yeah.
No, it is. It's always fun, you know, people working the clever ways on that. But, you know, and this is true, you know, not just the Wildcat Extension District does these soil samples. I mean, this is going to be any extension office wherever, you know, in the 4 states.
Right. Exactly. Yep. Any extension office offers soil sampling. So you can take a soil sample and take it to your closest extension office.
And I know, like you said, you're starting to get a little busy, so there may be a bit of a delay, but about how long does it take to get these results back?
Usually we aim for a week to 10 days turnaround time.
Okay, not bad.
So when you get those results back, we'll give you, you know, the test results for the soil sample, and also fertilizer recommendations for what you're planning on growing. And for food plots, a lot of times people haven't exactly decided what they want to grow yet. Or they're just doing a food plot mix. So we can give more general recommendations for those cases as well.
So do you send those into Manhattan, or can you do anything at the office? Who actually processes, I guess, the sample?
Yeah, so people bring them in to our office, and then we send them to the soil lab on campus in Manhattan, and they actually run the soil test and then send us the results back.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Well, anything else that people should know? I know it's a busy time of year, so get into it.
Not really. Make sure that when you're taking your soil samples, you get an even quantity of soil from the top to the bottom. Everything is based on the 6-inch soil profile. And so if you just skim it off the surface, it's not going to be accurate. Nutrients are very stratified. So you have to make sure it's an even, nice core from top to bottom of that 6 inches, because...
And also, one other thing is when you're putting your soil cores in a bucket and mixing them together, make sure it's a plastic bucket and that it's a clean bucket, that you haven't just been, applying, had potting soil in it or mineral in it or something like that, because that can influence those nutrient levels in the soil.
So is it maybe even a post hole digger would be good, just to go straight down maybe and get that?
Actually into those bulb planters, those flower bulb planters.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
If you don't have a soil probe, those are actually about 6 inches and pretty cylinder shaped.
Yeah.
So you can wiggle those. It takes longer than using a soil probe, but you can get those to work.
Okay.
So.
No, some good tips there. Alrighty. Well, hey, we've got a lot more coming up here in a moment. James, you want to give us a little bit of a preview of what you want to talk about
today?
Yeah,
so I'm going to talk a little bit about the wheat crop. It's out there right now. It's growing fast. It's looking beautiful, but there are some places that don't look as beautiful as others. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. And I don't, if you want to, if we have time, we can actually talk a little bit about rangeland burning and fire safety too.
That's
so
great.
You brought up the topic of wildfires. So
it's
going to
be a timely topic, because here on Friday things are going to get interesting. So all right, well, that sounds good. We'll be right back here in just a few minutes on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Good morning, 810 here on the Mighty 690, continuing our chat with folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And got James Coover now up to the plate, and a crop agent for the Wildcat District. So how you doing, James?
Yeah, doing good.
Good deal. So I've been driving around taking a look at the winter wheat and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, how is it looking?
It's looking pretty good, actually. I mean, usually when the rest of the state's dry, that's when we have good wheat, because we're drier too, which is... beneficial for us, because wheat does not like wet feet, and so it's actually working out pretty well. But it's not all perfect out there. There are some yellow spots, diseases, and some other things that we always see this time of year, no different than normal. But the wheat's going pretty fast right now, and so the soil temperature is getting above that 50 degree mark when the wheat really starts to take off. We're slightly behind last year. We've had those frosts that we've been getting every once in a while, really slows it down. We're likely around feet six. Wheat developments in feeks, for some reason. I don't know exactly what feeks stands for.
Wow.
But basically it means jointing. And so we're just about to that point where there's a tiny little head right now at the bottom of the stem that's starting to come out. If you crack open a wheat stem, you can actually see what looks like a little miniature wheat head in the bottom there. So right now is actually when the size of the wheat head and the number of meshes, which is little things that hold the kernels, is being formed. And so it happens way, way before you see it at all. All of
that
is actually developed and decided by that plant beforehand. So sensitivity to cold, of course, increases. If we have that really cold, like one of those Arctic things that comes in really late, it could damage our wheat. I don't see that in the forecast. Hopefully that doesn't happen, but it is a possibility at this point to see that wheat damage. And so right now we'll start to see some yellowing wheat. Most of that is from nitrogen or sulfur deficiencies. It can be temporary in nature. Even if you've applied nitrogen, you can still see those nitrogen deficiencies. And they'll go away in a little bit after the wheat kind of, the roots will catch up with the top part of the plant. And so that will be work itself out.
So if you see a little bit of yellow, it may be, you don't have to panic. It may resolve itself.
And it's different when it's a nitrogen deficiency, or maybe even the pH of the soil itself. And so if it's a soil issue, it follows along big trends within the field. And so it'll be a big splotchy area within the field The tire tracks, actually, the sprayers, those tend to be more green. And the field edges, they'll tend to be more green because they get overlapped, and because if you squish the soil down, you've made a spot where nitrogen is less likely to be deficient because of the plant itself, actually. So, you know, if that's the case, that is possible. However, there's also some diseases out there as well. So now and before now is when we start to see soil mosaic virus. There's all kinds of mosaic viruses. In this part of Kansas, we get the soil mosaic virus. It's actually caused by a swimming fungus, a little spore that swims around in the fungus. A lot of our crop diseases are actually caused by that. And that swimming little fungus, what it does to the plant in the fall is it infects it. And then in the spring, you start to see this splotchiness to the leaves. It doesn't look like they're not brown and necrotic like other diseases, but they're just, they look funny. I mean, they're splotchy throughout it. We also get barley yellow dwarf. And so from this point on, all the way almost to heading of the wheat, barley yellow dwarf starts to take over and be more important. And this is actually spread by aphids in the fall. Aphids that spread at this time of year, it's not as important because the virus doesn't have time to infect the whole plant. But that looks different. It looks basically like firing on the end of the plant. And so you'll see some browns, some purples, some reds at the leaf tips. And so, and you get some yellowing in that aspect as well. So if you see some yellowing throughout the field, you have to go out there and look at it because you don't know which one of those it is. It could even be some aphids too. And so the bird cherry oat aphid is the one that's active right now. And you know they cause a lot of damage, but then later on the green bugs, which are the little tiny green aphids, they will really start to take off about mid-April, and they can just explode in numbers. I mean, it could be nothing, and then in 3 days, they're just everywhere. I mean, one aphid can lay hundreds of eggs, and they hatch like in a few days.
Oh my!
And you know every aphid can lay eggs too because they're all asexual. So like it doesn't matter. It's very fast population growth. I will say though, however, we've all seen the ladybugs out there. We've all seen the little lace bugs. It seems like the beneficials are really starting to take off. So
yeah, I saw a ladybug like a month ago. I was like, what the heck?
Yes. Yeah. Wild. Yeah. Like, anytime it's warm out, and now that it's kind of getting warm, they're leaving our houses, actually. They like to live on the siding of our houses.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and attics and tree bark and whatever. They're coming out. So they're doing their work, and actually I haven't seen a whole lot of major aphids yet because of that.
Fingers crossed. So is there anything else that farmers need to be looking out for?
So they need to be looking out, you know, soon the rust diseases will start to blow in. We're not seeing those yet. Those happen about mid-April to late April is when those really start to be a problem. Stripe rust is first. It likes temperatures around 50 to 60 degrees, high humidity, which we haven't really been getting. And it doesn't survive here. It has to blow in from Texas. So what Texas looks like is a big component how bad our rust is going to be. And it's been a little bit like Kansas, actually. The eastern part has gotten a lot of rain. The western part has gotten none. So I haven't seen a whole lot of maps about how bad the forecast is going to be. There have been some reports of rust in Texas, and probably very soon there'll be reports of rust in Oklahoma. We always look at the OSU for the rust update for them because we're next. I haven't seen a whole lot yet. I don't think it's going to be a bad rust year just because it's so dry out there. But it's not how dry it is here. It's how dry it is south of us. So that's the real question.
And is that rust, I guess, report, does that come with the crop progress reports? Or how is that? Who measures that? Yes. How can you find that information?
So it's pretty much measured. There's a couple of different places. There is a national rust map by one of the schools does that. But honestly, checking out OSU, that's who I really concentrate on. And the pathologist there, she sends out updates.
Okay.
And so I keep a hold of that and make sure and see what it is. Looking at Stillwater, honestly, is sure. The one I look at the most to see how much that rust. But there are some national rust maps too. And if you see rust, please let me know, because I can put our counties on that map so that way the farmers up farther north of us know it's coming.
Yeah.
So it's pretty important for all that to happen. But for the most part, if you're seeing something weird in your field, you can't identify it, you don't know what it is, give me a call. I'll be happy to come out and take a look. I've got some field visits today. Some wheat fields.
Sure. Well, and that's helpful in, you know, trying to identify, you know, what you're dealing with, because, you know, this sort of thing seems like, you know, we definitely want to catch it early when we can.
Yes. Yeah. These things can, they take off real fast. And so, I mean, and to fix those problems, you can't always fix them, but if you can fix them, you gotta do it quickly as well.
Sure. And I haven't checked the, I know we had the crop progress report come out, I think, yesterday. I haven't had a chance to look at it. But any other observations that any of you seen comparing us to the rest of the state?
Yeah, on the crop progress report, I mean, really, a lot of the state's just a little bit farther behind. Generally speaking, we're already starting to plant corn at this point. Farmers don't like to wait until the soil temperatures are right. They like to get out there. But, I mean, the soil temperatures are still too low. I mean, we need to get to at least 55 degrees to plant corn. But it's hard for them to wait.
Yeah, I'm wearing short sleeves some days. Come on,
yes,
I need to get out here.
But I tell you, by the beginning of next week, it doesn't matter if the soil temperatures are right or not, they're going to be planting corn. Because it's the beginning of April, there's going to be corn in the ground. But hopefully in the next few days, that warmer temperatures will kind of help that soil a little bit.
Sure.
So.
Sure. Well, good deal. Now, how did your grafting workshop go?
It went pretty well, really. I mean, it was a beautiful day out there. And we had quite a few people. And, I mean, we grafted... I don't know. I chopped down a whole bunch of Calgary pear trees around my yard. I don't really care about them. And so hopefully the grass will take. We'll see what happens.
That's fun. You know, I have been a little surprised because it's especially, you know, just going around, this time of year, the Bradford pears are so obvious. You know,
yes.
I didn't realize how many there are because, you know, just going around, they kind of blend in throughout the rest of the year. But this time of year, boy, you can tell. And there are more than I expected here in Coffeyville.
Yeah. Once you know what you're looking for, you drive around and it's like, they are invasive.
And even,
they really are.
Even some of these unmanaged fields and pastures and that sort of thing, they're everywhere. Just little ones all over the place. I'm like,
and they're not supposed to be there. I mean, they're not native to here. They're from China. And they come in and, like, birds love to spread them everywhere. And they're not really nutritious for birds either. Pollinators, they're not very fond. Pollinators aren't very fond of them either. So, not really a good deal. But, I don't know. I guess they're pretty for a week. So, that's why we got them.
You know, that is, I guess, yeah, you get that. It is interesting. I've went to Fredonia and they had the presentation on the town of Buffville, which is no longer around. But they had some old pictures. And what is so striking in those old pictures is you have like a school building, you know, built there. And there's nothing else. There's no trees. It just literally looks like a desert sort of. And so it's so wild that big difference from, you know, 100 years ago to now and the number of trees that we have in the area.
Yeah. And that actually, when you were talking about prescribed burning or burning before, that's a large component to it, is that the old Kansas there weren't trees like we have now. This wasn't a forest state. I mean, it was just plains. As far as you could see, there were some trees basically right against the creeks and maybe on some of the bluffs where the fires, I mean, they could escape the fire.
Yeah.
But, I mean, a lot of the trees here were gone. It wasn't a forest.
Sure.
I mean, anywhere.
Well, speaking of fire, we do have coming up here on Friday some chance of a little bit of fire weather. It's actually going to be way worse out in western Kansas, but still something to be thinking about. We do have some watches already issued for Elk and Chautauqua counties. So as we kind of go into this season, is there anything we should know about, you know, burning of fields and pastures, that sort of thing?
Yes. And so... this year, I mean, we're going to be burning just like we do every single year, prescribed burning. This isn't wildfire.
Yeah.
This is an intentional burn. It's important for the ecology of the range. This has been shown many, many times. We have to burn because that's what the range needs. But there, you know, a component to range burning is understanding how to do it. It's very important that your range burn doesn't turn into a wildfire. The wildfire isn't what you're trying to avoid. And so, of course, wildfires... they happen a lot when it's windy out, when the temperatures get higher, the humidity gets lower, which is why this time of year, wildfires start to take off. So if you're thinking about prescribed burning, don't be scared of it. It's fine. People do it all the time, and you can too, on your rangeland. And so first, check the burn maps. Make sure we're not in a burn ban. Usually when you're in a burn ban, it has a lot to do with humidity. The ideal range for humidity is around 40 to 60%. Which is most of the time, actually. So temperature, of course, the hotter it is, the more chance for that fire to take off. Wind and the direction of the wind is probably the most important component. Because when you're prescribed burning, you got to have a plan, got to have a map. Ideally speaking, you're going to have a whole listed plan out for your prescribed burn. And so know where the fire needs to go, know what direction it needs to go, pull up Google Maps and, you know, make directions and all that part to it. Also, let your fire people know. Call your local fire chief. They want to know before and after. First of all, people are going to be calling.
Yes.
Because they're going to see the smoke.
Yes.
So don't leave them hanging, because they're going to be wondering what's going on.
Because we hear, I've heard it, I think, just last week there on the scanner, you know, they send out the volunteer fire department, and it's a planned burn. So.
Yes, yes.
And that wastes everyone's time and money.
Exactly.
We have volunteer fire, you know, fighters who have to leave work and all that sort of thing. So.
Yeah, and, I mean, if you plan with them, you know, maybe it's the volunteer, you have a volunteer out there kind of watching and helping too, because they got the trucks with the sprayers and all that, which is brings up another point: have the right equipment. Make sure that you have all the sprayers, your proper burners, like the Panama burners or torch burners or whatever it is that you're prepared for, proper PPE. You're gonna be going around in smoke, so make sure you got your mask on. Last year I kind of got some smoke insulation from fighting fires in the fall, and it's not fun, so you know, make sure you have enough people as well. You can't always do this by yourself. In fact, you almost can't do this by yourself. It requires a whole team of people with their little side-by-sides and sprayers and all that stuff. Be prepared. Also, make sure that you have the right fire breaks, too. And so have your full plan addressed. Wait for the right day. Be watching the weather channel, make sure, or whatever, the weather, and so you can make sure that the wind direction, humidity, and all that's correct. And so, you know, don't be scared of it, though. I know a lot of people don't want to burn anymore because it's too scary for wildfires. However, what do we end up with? We have cedar trees and, you know, pear trees all over the place.
Yeah.
There's a lot of rangeland out there that really use a good burn, honestly.
And, absolutely, because things can just get out of control as far as, you know, the trees and everything. And
yeah,
you get a mess.
I can see this year's burn going to be a little bit less because of the drought.
Uh-huh.
And so there's just less fuel load this year, at least in this area. But, I mean, even still, there's probably a little bit, there's enough out there in a lot of fields to go ahead and do it. So.
Sure. Well, and then, too, the other thing is, I mean, heck, you drive around the Flint Hills in the evening and some of these, you see some of the most beautiful Kansas things you've ever seen. I mean, that is, to me, just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
When you get these beautiful burn. Lines of fire.
Snakes that go up the hills.
My gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, Osage Questas and Flint Hills, you get some very pretty pictures.
Yeah.
So photographers will be out for sure. I love it. Well, hey, a good reminder there. James and Davin, if people have questions for you, you know, what's the best way to get a hold of you? And Davin, maybe one more time, just going over if people are interested in getting on this wildlife judging, that sort of thing, getting kids signed up for that.
Yeah, if any kids are interested in signing up for that, they can give me a call at the Independence office. That number is 620-331-2690.
Good deal. And James?
Yeah, and there's plenty of resources out there for prescribed burning. You're getting all that information out there, a lot of it, actually. And so the Kansas Forest Service got a good one. The Great Plains Burning Association also has a lot of good resources, and K-State Extension does, too. And so if you have trouble finding any of that stuff, give me a call, 620-724-8233.
Okay, well, very good. Always a good chat with you guys, and look forward to talking again soon.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be getting started with an early bird edition of Open Line on the way here on KGGF.